And it will come to order.
Okay.
Messages from the House.
February the 28th, 2012, from the House of Representatives. Third reading passed. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed the House on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill Number 35, Notarial Certification of Business Entity Instrument. Ayes 57, excused 3. House Bill Number 65, Banks Authorized Investments. Ayes 55, noes 1, excused 3. House Bill Number 77, Charter Schools Average Daily Membership. Ayes 57, noes 6, excused 3. House Bill 92, 9/11 Service Eligible Entities. Ayes 57, excused 3. House Bill Number 95, Student to Teacher Ratio Waiver. Ayes 57, excused 3. House Bill Number 113, Critical Access Endowment Challenge Program. Ayes 57, excused 3. House Joint Resolution Number 8, National Day of the Cowboy. Ayes 57, excused 3. And House Joint Resolution Number 7, Resolution Conscience Rights. Ayes 40, noes 17, excused 3. February the 28th, 2012, from the House of Representatives. Third reading passed, amended. Mr. President, the bills listed below pass the House on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. House Bill Number 7, Voluntary Livestock Identification Program. Ayes 32, noes 25, excused 3. House Bill Number 34, Subdivision, Consideration of Schools, Substitute 1. Ayes 36, noes 21, excused 3. House Bill Number 46, Handicap Parking, Space Size and Marking. Ayes 57, excused 3. House Bill Number 48, 80 miles per hour speed limit. Ayes 46, noes 1, excused 3. House Bill Number 76, Resort Liquor Licenses. Ayes 53, noes 4, excused 3. House Bill Number 89, Workplace Safety Employer Assistance. Ayes 52, noes 5, excused 3. House Bill Number 112, Battery Against a Family Member. Ayes 42, noes 15, excused 3. House Bill Number 116, Impact Assistance to Local Governments. Ayes 49, noes 8, excused 3. House Bill Number 119, Health Insurance Sale of Out-of-State Policies. Ayes 56, noes 1, excused 3. House Joint Resolution Number 1, Resolution in Support of ANWR Energy Development. Ayes 47, noes 10, excused 3. House Joint Resolution Number 10, Rural Long Distance Phone Service. Ayes 56, noes 1, excused 3. House Joint Resolution Number 12, United States Government Deficits. Ayes 55, noes 2, excused 3. House Joint Resolution Number 13, Resolution in Support of Central Park Wilderness. Ayes 32, noes 23, excused 2, conflict 3. House Bill Number 18, Notification of Public Lands Tenants, Water Right Changes. Ayes 49, noes 8, excused 3. House Bill Number 62, Investigative Subpoenas, Ayes 34, Noes 23, Excused 3. House Bill Number 108, Professional Teaching Standard Board Teacher Certification, Ayes 57, Excused 3. February the 28th, 2012, from the House of Representatives, Message Number 174, Third Reading Failed. Mr. President, the bill listed below failed to pass the House on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill Number 85, Government Continuity. Ayes 27, noes 30, excused 3. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
House bills on first reading. House Bill 35, first reading of the bill.
House Bill 35, sponsored by Representative Geer, Non-Notarial Certification of Business Entity Instrument. We doing first reading? Oh, okay. Pass the House on third reading. Ayes 57, excused 3. Forgot where we were.
House Bill 35 is assigned to Committee Number 7, Corporations. House Bill 65, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill Number 65, sponsored by Representative Stubson, Banks, Authorized Investments. Pass the House on third reading. Ayes 55, excused 3.
House Bill 65, assigned to Committee 7, Corporations. House Bill 77, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill Number 77, sponsored by Representative Conley, Charter Schools Average Daily Membership. Pass the House on third reading. Ayes 51, noes 6, excused 3.
House Bill 77 is assigned to Committee 4, Education. House Bill 92, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill 92, sponsored by Representative Kraft, 9/11 Services Eligible Entities, an act relating to emergency telephone service. Pass the House on third reading. Ayes 57, excused 3.
House Bill 92 is referred to Committee 7, Corporations. House Bill 95, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill Number 95, sponsored by Representative Patton, Student-to-Teacher Ratio Waiver, and Act Relating to Education. Pass the House on third reading. Ayes 57, excused 3.
House Bill 95, referred to Committee Number 4, Education. House Bill 113, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill 113, sponsored by Representative Bonner, Critical Access Endowment Challenge Program, and Act Relating to Public Health. Pass the House on third reading. Ayes 57, excused 3.
House Bill 113 is assigned to Committee 10, Labor Health. House Joint Resolution 8.
House Joint Resolution 8, National Day of the Cowboy, sponsored by Representative Lockhart, a joint resolution requesting Congress and the Wyoming Governor to designate the fourth Saturday in July as National Day of the Cowboy. Pass the House on third reading. Ayes 57, excused 3.
House Joint Resolution 8 is assigned to Committee Number 5, Agriculture. Reports from standing committees.
February the 28th, 2012, Mr. President, your committee number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivision, to whom was referred House Bill 5, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Martin, and Scott, Senator Case, Chairman. February the 28th, 2012, Mr. President, your committee number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivision, to whom was referred House Bill 15, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Martin, and Scott, Senator Case, Chairman. February the 28th, 2012, Mr. President, your committee number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivision, to whom was referred House Bill 16, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Martin, and Scott, Senator Case, Chairman. February the 28th, 2012, Mr. President, your committee number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivision, to whom was referred House Joint Resolution 6, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, and Johnson. No, Senators Martin and Scott. Senator Case, Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we are at that order of business for consideration of bills on general file.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate resolve itself back into Committee of the Whole for consideration of bills on general file.
Heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion is carried, and I'd ask Senator Nutting to come back to the desk, please.
Committee of the Whole will come to order. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. May I have privilege of the floor?
Yes, you may.
Okay. I'd like to introduce to the Senate a distinguished young lady who's here in Cheyenne. Many of you know that the Rotary Clubs all over the world have exchange students. We have outbound students. I know one that's going to go in September to Italy, and then we have the inbound students that come to Cheyenne, sponsored by the Rotary Club. Right now we had one. We just sent one home back to Brazil, and at the beginning of the year, one back to Formosa and one back to Australia. But I would like to introduce our current one. She's a senior at East High School. Wish me luck. Paola Jaramillo.
Close enough.
Thank you. She is from Toluca, Mexico. It's a half an hour from Mexico City, a million population. It's also at the city at the highest altitude in Mexico. Now, on my Rotary badge, I have a Mexican flag, and we're required to do something with her, whatever like that, and then we can take our Mexican flag off. And I've waited since she got here in September to bring her to the Senate so that she could be honored and she could see how Wyoming is run. So please welcome Pal.
Welcome to the Senate. The first bill for our consideration is House Bill 32. The reading clerk will read the House bill.
House Bill number 32, sponsored by the Corporations Committee, redistricting of the legislature, an act relating to state legislative districts. I assume there's a It was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporation Election and Political Subdivision, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Martin, and Scott. Senator Case, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Case.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a due pass recommendation on House Bill 32, redistricting of the legislature, and I would call for the question at this time. Madam Chairman, well, it's a great pleasure to stand here today and to tell you about the trip that we've taken since we last were together in this chamber last year. Redistricting, of course, was assigned to the Corporations Committee, and I want to thank them and thank the staff and lots of folks out there that participated. It's been a very long process, Madam Chairman, with a lot of public involvement. We held a total of 13 public hearings. In addition, we spent we had 5 regular meetings devoted to the subject. Some of those meetings were multiple days. We met all across Wyoming. I can tell you the towns. I bet I can tell you every one of them. Many of the meetings were lightly attended and fairly mild and almost a picnic atmosphere. Some had pitchforks and burning buildings. I swear, Madam Chairman, it seemed like that. We also involved local officials, most notably. The clerks of our counties became very involved and very helpful in the process. In many cases, clerks or legislators or other local officials spearheaded local efforts, and they had their own set of local meetings. And some counties had several rounds of meetings to try to get to consensus on redistricting. And just before we do that, Matt, I might ask you to put up the population table, if you don't mind. Just to give you a little flavor of why we're here, recall that our Constitution calls for a somewhat proportional establishment of senators and House members by population, and that was within the context of counties. That arrangement held in Wyoming until the election that began in 1992. And it was a result of a court case where that system was thrown out by the court. And we have gone, that's at the time that we adopted single-member districts. And this is now the third iteration, which you're going to see, of down the roll of single-member districts. But you can see from this table here why it's impossible to have a static districts, because our population in Wyoming is so dramatic. And this chart, which is available on the website and for the public to view, tells about the population of our counties from 1960 to 2010. And you can see the cumulative changes are astounding. As we change, you can see that the largest single change occurred in Campbell County, which since 1960 has increased by almost 700%, an astounding figure. Other large ones are Teton County, Uinta County, Sublette County. They're all Laramie County, Natrona County. They all grew. Some counties didn't grow so fast. And we actually have in Wyoming, as our economy has changed and things have happened, is that we have some counties that actually have fewer people today than they had in 1960. So that's kind of a flavor of the dynamics of trying to establish districts based on an underlying change in population. That's why we're here today. And since the year 2000, we've also had some fairly dramatic changes in population, probably more so than happened in the previous 10 years. Most astounding, the energy development counties of Sublette and Campbell County really are off the charts. And also Teton County. So we can see that the tourism-based Teton County and the energy-based Sublette and Campbell counties really drove why the greatest changes in redistricting. So, Matt, if we could go to what we came up with. This is where we stand today. This map that you see represents the redistricting plan brought by the committee with a fairly significant amendment that was adopted in the House. With that, I want to tell you how we got here. We approached this at our first meeting. We adopted specific principles with respect to redistricting. Those principles are also available on the website. We talked about whether or not we should maintain the existing structure of the Senate having 30 members and the House having 60 members. We talked about whether or not how well we could respect communities of interest. And we talked about counties and how county boundaries were important in the process. We adopted a regional approach largely on the basis of the advice of one committee member who had been through this a couple of times before. The tall senator from Natrona County suggested a regional-based approach, which we found very workable as we went forward in the committee. And so there were sort of some natural coalition and working groups. We might talk about some of them. They actually trust me with a pointer here, Madam Chairman, and I'll try not to wipe you out. But one of the areas that we established as kind of a regional working group was in southwest Wyoming and extended on up into Teton County. That was the subject of numerous meetings. I'm going to guess that folks in that area and legislators in that area held 10 meetings, a lot of leadership to try to come up with things. We looked at the structure of the Bighorn Basin. We held hearings in the Bighorn Basin, and we tried to establish districts that respected the boundaries of the basin. We even, at one point in our hearing process, we had two public hearings in the basin, and we looked at the possibility, and it was requested by local legislators in the area, that we actually allow our deviations to be a little bit larger than we had been inclined to support. And the committee voted to adopt plus or minus 5%. That's a very important number because that totals 10%, obviously. But a 10% deviation in our districts across the state is sort of the magic number that means that we pass the first test if you end up in federal court on a redistricting question. If you have deviation greater than 10%, the burden of proof shifts, and our job becomes more difficult. The committee said, let's stay within deviation. But in the Bighorn Basin, that became impossible to maintain districts that were wholly within the basin and within deviation. We decided not to bend our rules. And what happened as a consequence of that is this piece down here, which is in Fremont County, is now included in legislative districts with the Bighorn Basin. Another area that was adopted was on the other side of the mountains was Johnson and Sheridan County. They worked together and largely came up with plans in that area. We have Natrona County. Legislators in Natrona County and the clerk there largely came up with this plan. Southeast Wyoming and also Eastern Wyoming. These are the plans resulting from those meetings. Lots and lots of consternation. But this is where we are. I will tell you the hardest and most difficult things that happen is not everybody's happy over here. I can tell you that. We're definitely going to hear about that. The committee's not happy that we ended up with this gigantic House district here. That's huge. That's our biggest House district in Wyoming. As you can see, that goes from Rock River over here clear over, this is where Rock Springs is, so this is your Farson area over there. Gigantic. We looked at alternatives with respect to that. The committee had as a working deal to split the town of Rawlins, to have these districts making up this area actually have a combination of within Rawlins and outside of Rawlins to try to manage the size of it. I'll tell you what, we heard from almost every person in Rawlins, I believe, and they did not like that idea. And they truly would rather prefer this arrangement with this very large House district surrounding the more urban Rawlins area. Another area that was always difficult was over in here. Sublette County. This is, if you recall, if you look at our existing map of districts, and there's no need to bring it up, but one of the bittersweet things perhaps from the last time we redistricted was when a district was created, not by the committee, but upon actions of the House and Senate, which put the town of Wilson and the large communities, sort of large for Sublette County status, Pinedale, Big Piney, all together in a district. And that has been unsatisfactory by many accounts for that period. Well, Sublette County was very adamant that this time they had grown, they have made it, they deserve to have a district that within their county. And I think the committee found that a favorable thing, but it caused lots of problems. We had a hard time with the community of interest over here in the Star Valley to try to find the right compromise to make folks over there as happy as can be. And in the end, I think we've done a pretty good job, but we still have, there's definitely controversy about Uinta County and the structure of this district here, this purple area, as it winds around. There's kind of two ways to do that, and you can see this is the area of Lyman and in the Bridger Valley, and there have been proposals advanced for this piece that's over here to actually be on this side of the county and pick up this. And that would leave the town of Evanston more relatively whole. We tried looking at that. We didn't find support on the committee to do that. And in the end, it was decided that Evanston was already split, and we were going to not really help it that much by removing one of the three splits that were there. But on the other hand, we'd be splitting the Bridger Valley, and that was very important and perhaps a stronger community of interest. A lot of the difficulties of how we got here, but this is where we are. And I'd like to, what I think I'd like to show you is in detail how we got here, but I'm going to do it through the Standing Committee Amendment, if it's all right. So I would ask that the Standing Committee Amendment be read in. And Mr. President, Madam Chairman, I think Mr. President.
Madam Chairman, I apologize for interrupting. Perhaps before the amendment is read in would be the most appropriate break in the action. So if I may, I would like to have privilege of the floor.
Mr. President, you may.
Thank you. Members of the body, we have indeed, I think, a special group with us today, a very special delegation whom I was fortunate enough to have lunch with, along with a number of other legislators. I'd like to introduce them individually, and I know that's somewhat irregular given the time schedule that we are on, but I think that these students deserve our recognition. So I'm going to read their names with their hometown, and as I read your names, I'd like to have you stand, and then we'll keep our applause until the end. So forgive me if I slip a little bit on the names, but I'll do the best I can. Jeff Bank, Cody, Jacob Barnes, Gillette, Landon Blumel, Lyman, Tanner Clark, Cody, Stephen Flynn, Laramie, Matthew Fournier, Cheyenne, Charlie Grubbs, Cheyenne, Chris Ideen, Casper, Loyal Johnson, Rollins, Nathan Kahn, Rock Springs, Matthew Caples, Casper, Ashley Clone, Casper, Dean Lorimer, Casper, Stephanie Linden, Casper, Matson, Mathay, Green River, Maxwell Matson, from Lander, D.P. Patel, Cheyenne, Griffin Sharp, Cheyenne, Mel Wiffle from Laramie, Hope Wilson from Cheyenne, and along with these WAMI students today is Susan Allen, M.D., Vice Dean of the Regional Affairs University of Washington School of Medicine in Seattle, along with Ellen Cosgrove, M.D., Vice Dean of the Academic Affairs, University of Washington School of Medicine. Welcome, students and members of the body. Let's give them a very warm welcome. Thank you, Senator Case. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I know some of the young man from Laramie, somebody I've known for a long time, but Griffin Sharp is my nephew. His mother works over here. She works, if you call it work, over in the House attorneys.
Senator Case.
Madam Chairman, if I could have the Standing Committee Amendment read in, please.
The reading clerk will read in the Standing Amendment.
House Bill 32, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engrossed copy, page 4, line 7.
Madam Chairman, I would move the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 32 and What this is very much cleanup language, and we're going to go through the cleanup. What happened is, you know, this census data is very detailed, and you have to really, it's driven by what's called census blocks. That's the lowest kind of common piece of data that we can use to build our Senate and House districts. And when you draw a map, you think you've got it right, and then sometimes when you go back and look at it, you find that there might be little pockets that you missed, or maybe the county clerk in the various areas says, well, you know, this would be very helpful if you could just make this small move. So these are a series of small amendments brought largely by the county clerks that have become aware of us since our last meeting of the committee in January. And staff has been very diligent in asking the clerks to comment on that proposal and get their suggested changes and cleanup. And so, Matt, should we start with Weston County, kind of that first? Is that the plan? So we'll go into Weston County. And the purpose of doing all this is you'll see the detail of the data and what it really takes to make an amendment or also to develop a plan. So in Weston County, we cleaned up some boundaries to match the current House District 1 and the House District 2 boundary line. We moved the line to follow the highway. And again, this was done on behalf of the county clerks. So Matt's illustrating the section. This is House District 2 area, and that area is now in House District 2, but was previously in House District 1. Are there any people in that area, Matt? I don't see a soul. One person. Caught one person in that. So show us the, is that the only one for Weston? Show us the other one. Okay, and here we have some offset that was previously in House District 2 and is now in House District 1, and I think we've got one person in that move. The top boundary has zero persons, but the bottom one has one. Sometimes these are voter confidentiality issues when you get to look at all the various districts. When a clerk is preparing a ballot, she's got to worry about which school district, which legislative district, in or out of the city, college districts, what have you. And it gets down to where someone gets a unique ballot, that when that ballot's tabulated, that may violate voter confidentiality. Some of those. So is it time to move to Converse County? In Converse County, we'll give it a second to come up here. We've got this area here, which was previously in House District 2 and is now in House District... I'm sorry, it was previously in House District 4 and is now in House District 3. And this was done to make the clerk split easier. Is that the only change in Converse? Show me the offset. Where would we be without staff? I guarantee you we wouldn't have got anywhere. Here's another one, and also that's kind of the same thing that was previously in 3 and is now in 4. There was a switch there. We got to do this pantomime thing. Hold on a second. So are we ready to go to Campbell County? Okay, we're in the area of Campbell County, and we've switched two areas within the city of Gillette to make the clerk's boundary splits better. One switch is from House District 3 to House District 32. House District 32 would be the purple. House District 3 would be the green. And you can see the area Matt's trying to highlight that's got the crosshatches. That moved from 3 to 32. And can we go to the other change, Matt, which would be, we're still in Campbell County. We're still around Gillette. And what we're doing here is making a change from House District 32 to House District 53. 32 would be the area of the purple, and 53 would be the area of, that's kind of a dirty pink color. And you can see I
There's like 65 people in that, according to the map, roughly.
Again, that was brought on behalf of the clerks. Go to Fremont County. And some of the challenges in Fremont County involve the Native American population, who in the process of establishing legislative districts in Wyoming, the area occupied by the Wind River Indian Reservation and the Native American folks that live there, have enough population to meet the threshold to be called what's called a minority-majority district, meaning that there is a protected minority population that has the potential to constitute the majority of a district as we establish it. Indeed, that's the case in Fremont County. And to actually try to maintain and keep that majority as strong as possible, some of these changes were involved around the city of Riverton. And also, after we got into that, it's pretty complicated, and there were just several cleanups. And you can see we mainly switched some areas around Riverton to follow several roadways and to make the boundary line uniform along the river. That would be the Big Wind River. We moved a few boundaries in Riverton to make the clerk's splits easier. The changes were largely between House District 33 and House District 55. And then we also made changes between House District 33 and 34, and between 34 and 55. A number of changes were made, swapping back and forth, and this was on the behest of the Fremont County clerk. And so it's kind of complicated in areas. The geography is along the river is kind of intricate, I guess, for lack of a better word. And you get these weird triangles, and a lot of this was cleanup. So these are all changes in this area. If anybody has any specific questions about the changes, it'd be a good time to stop me. Okay, I think we're ready to go to Laramie County. In Laramie County, we moved a couple of blocks to clean up the boundary line along the major roadways. One block was changed between House District 44 into House District 8. So you can see that the more yellow color, the brighter yellow, is House District 44. The other one is House District 8. And that area that's got the crosshatches moved from 44 into 8. And there's also a small change from House District 44 into House District 42, and that's the area of that crosshatch. So, again, that was brought, I think that was brought by the Laramie County Clerk. So those are the physical changes to the bill that occurred in the Standing Committee Amendment. We didn't do those changes. We could have ran those changes in the other side, but then you'd have to have an engrossed bill. And so it seemed like we just waited and see if more of those would accumulate. There's actually one more of those kind of small changes that I believe the good senator from Goshen County is going to bring on behalf of his clerk, and the committee supports that, and that'll be coming up next. The only other change was a slight change in verbiage where staff recommended that we, on page 4, line 7, delete that office received and insert received by that office. So I guess, Madam Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions about the Standing Committee Amendment. There's really no significant policy changes in the Standing Committee Amendment, and if we're going to go, I'll wait a question.
Senator Beavout.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just a question so I understand the sequence of events. You had the committee bill that we all saw and that you had worked to the committee and recommended. Then it went to the House, and they made some changes, and now you have your Standing Committee Amendment. Could you walk us through that again so we understand where you started before the session, what the House changed or didn't change, and how you are now today with these changes that you're proposing in the Standing Committee Amendment?
Senator Case?
Certainly, Madam Chairman. If we're to look at the big map with these little changes that we just went through in the Standing Committee Amendment, they're not going to even show up. I mean, these are so tiny in the corners of all these. There's no major issues with respect to the Standing Committee Amendment. But the Senator's question is an excellent one, is what was the difference between the bill as it was brought into the House? I'm sorry, didn't mean to use the other bodies. as it was presented by the committee, approved by the committee, and as it was changed. So, Matt, if you might help me, and with a little leeway, we can, from the chair, we can look at the changes that the House made, and if you can toggle back and forth between two, is that possible? Might take a moment to set this up. We'll start off to show that difference. We'll go over to the western side of Wyoming, and there was an amendment offered by the representative who lives in Wilson and represents lots and lots of different areas over there all the way down to Pinedale. And we're going to toggle between the two proposed changes there, which was adopted. So as you can see, you can look at this boundary line. It largely affects the boundary line right across here. And I know that Senator Dockstetter could help me with this as well. He was very involved in all this. I'm sorry, this boundary line right here. So this is before, right, Matt? This is after. Can you show us before? This is before. You can see this? And then can you do it again, toggle back and forth? After. That's the change in there. Involved the Star Valley. I would even yield to a good senator from Star Valley if he wanted to describe that change in a little bit more detail.
Senator Dockstetter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In answer to the question, we had originally we had a division right through Afton we had to take care of, and then we also had a division in Kemmerth.
Oh. It's on.
Maybe a little closer.
Okay, there we go. In answer to the question, we had an original division in Afton, and we also had an original division in Kemmerer that we had to take care of. And working with the good representative from up in the Wilson area, we were able to adjust those to address community of interest and take care of the division in both of those communities.
Madam Chairman, if I may, that's sort of a continuing evolution over there. It culminated with this motion and adoption by our good friends down the hall. The next one, should we go to Cheyenne with the one offered by the lady representative from Cheyenne? And I believe this was a swap between the last representative in the alphabet, or one of the last representatives in the alphabet, the younger one, and the kind lady senator or representative from Cheyenne, which just moved this boundary of this street right here. And I don't remember which way it moved, but moved it that way. So it probably, did it go up this way and it moved over a block? That was the change. And you, good senators from Laramie County probably know that in detail. If anybody wanted to offer some more comments, I'd... Okay. Think we're okay on that one? The next one is the good representative from Goshen County. They're all good from Goshen County, don't get me wrong. But we're talking about the representative, not the senator. He offered an amendment... and it involved the switching. I'm going to talk to Matt for just a second.
Thank you.
And I can't remember all the reasons for doing that, but perhaps the good senator from Goshen County could help us with why that switch was made.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. The switch was at the behest of the county clerks, but the good representative from Goshen County, there was some miscommunication between the clerk and the good representative from Goshen County, and so the clerk called me and said, Kirk, can you clean this thing up for me when you get to the Senate? And that's what we've done, and we'll talk about that at some time. I'm sure we'll bring that forward. That's the first committee of the whole amendment.
And Madam Chairman, the next change was actually this area over here in eastern Wyoming, this elongated section. And I think the easiest way to explain that would also be to yield to the good senator from Goshen County, who was involved in making that change and influenced its change in the House. I don't mean to put him on his spot, but if he'd like to explain it, or I can try to.
Yeah, certainly. Thank you, Madam Chairman. This is basically what we call the Eastern Option in Goshen County. The committee had what they would call a Southern Option, and they went up, I think, past Hot Springs across, took in about 850 to 60 people. We tried to figure out how we could actually look at lessening the impact and the impact of Goshen County as a community of interest. And so we had an opportunity to look at the population within the medium security correction facility up there. The folks don't vote, but they count. And I talked to the attorney general, and I said, what about this? I says, do we really have to count them? He says, are you sure we count them, Kurt? And I said, well, yeah, we sure do. And so what we were able to do was to just bring in 350 people along the side of Goshen County and come up and take in the correctional facility, which is at 499. And so when we did this, all we did was work within the boundaries of Goshen County. The rules were pretty much simple, is that hands off Laramie County, because you don't want to change anything in Laramie County, so don't go across the lines there. Platte County wants to stay completely whole, and don't go north and don't go into Converse County. So we stayed in our own backyard.
What about Nebraska?
We could take all the voters in Nebraska we wanted to make this plan work, but we didn't have to take any of those, Madam Chairman. So what it does end up doing is basically keeping a lesser impact on Goshen County. I have to explain to only 350 people why they've got to vote for a Laramie County senator or representative. We did have full support from the Laramie County representative, Representative Eklund, plus both representatives from Goshen County and our county commissioners, and did talk to our mayors and our local government officials across the county. So it's the best possible plan at this point in time for Goshen County that we're left up. If you want to just, you know, look at hypotheticals, if you draw a line above Goshen and Platte counties, you've got 8.1 House seats in Crook, Western, Campbell, Niobrara, and Converse. If you draw a line below that in Laramie, Goshen, and Platte, you've got 12.1 House seats. And we've got a plan for that, and it's a perfect plan within about 100 people deviation one way or the other. But, Madam Chairman, I think that basically my marching orders was stay away from Laramie County and everybody else and just work within Goshen County. We did that. We were able to come up with a plan that the House overwhelmingly supported.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I think that, back to the good senator from Fremont County, I think those four actions that we discussed were the subject of the amendments that were offered down the hall. That is what changed the bill from how the committee did it. Just to recap, it was this line right over here. It was the change in the area of Torrington.
It was a change in along the streets in Cheyenne. Sounds like a song. I walked out in the streets of Cheyenne. And then this, the creation of this strip of district over here. That were the changes made in the House, in the other body.
Senator Beavout.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And then the Standing Committee amendment is just tweaking it to clean up little things that really are not significant, unless you happen to be in one of those areas.
Madam Chairman, that's precisely correct. The Standing Committee amendment doesn't have any bearing on some of the policy discussions we might have about major directions. It was completely to... We had a name for the little lost sections that were ended up in the wrong place, because you got to understand, when you're clicking with a mouse to try to catch all those, sometimes you miss them. Sometimes the people reviewing it, like the clerks, miss it the first time through. So those little oops, all of those things in the subject of the Standing Committee Amendment, by and large, the largest one involves 65 people. The rest of them are very small amounts, some cases no people, some cases one or two people. And it really has no impact on any of the policy questions you might have about this bill. So that would be the discussion we've had of the Standing Committee Amendment, the changes that were derived as it's made its way over to our side. And I'd be happy to answer any more questions, or we could have we have a question.
I lost you. There you are. Senator Scott.
Madam Chairman, I will say I was on the committee, and I want to talk in respect to the Standing Committee Amendment, because it illustrates part of the process we went through. And, Madam Chairman, I want to talk more generally on the process we went through before we get to the Committee of the Whole amendments, but after the Standing Committee Amendment. But the Standing Committee Amendment, all generated by the clerks going through and reviewing the plan and looking for little things that didn't quite work. And, Madam Chairman, this was typical of the level of detail work that the county clerks did on this plan. And, you know, you heard we divided the state up into regions. Each of those regional plans was developed with a lot of input from the local county clerks. I think virtually all the clerks had input into the plans that were done, and it varied depending on the location, from actually drawing the original cut of the plan to being part of a group that drew it. And the clerks, in the first cut, you paid a lot of attention to what they call community of interest, which is basically putting voters with like interests with other voters with like interests. The clerks then had, once you got below that level, had a lot of input into first drawing boundaries that the voters could understand which district they were in. I know in Natrona County they suggested several changes that were adopted that were designed to get the boundaries, physical features that were readily identified, so people had an easier time figuring out which district they were in and who their representatives and who their senators were. And that's very useful. The other thing they did, they were trying to minimize the number of precinct splits where you have unique ballots for a relatively small number of individuals. That makes the elections a lot easier to administer. It avoids a lot of mistakes that could be made. Very useful in the election process to me. Means following school district boundaries, following other boundaries where possible, and it's not always possible. So what I want to say regarding the Standing Committee Amendment, this is just another example of the kind of detail but very valuable input that we got from the county clerks all over the state. And frankly, Madam Chairman, this whole thing was one of the smoothest redistrictings that I've seen. And a lot of the credit goes to the excellent work that the county clerks put in on it. And I think we can adopt things like this Standing Committee Amendment with considerable confidence that what they're doing makes a lot of sense.
All All those in favor of Senator Case's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to House Bill 32, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
That motion is carried. Senator Case.
Well, Madam Chairman, there are two Committee of the Whole amendments. Before we get to them, a couple of preliminary remarks might be in order. We had other issues that we had to address as the committee moved forward. One was the status of so-called holdover senators. That would be senators that had 2 years remaining on your term of office. And the question was, should all senators stand for election or not? And because your districts changed, and the committee looked and said, well, it's fairly obvious that we have more changes this time than we had 10 years ago. The population change is so dramatic, especially we mentioned Sublette, Teton County, Campbell County, but by and large, overall, urban areas grew. Rural areas didn't grow as much. Doesn't mean they didn't grow, but they didn't keep up with the rest of the state in many instances. So there was dramatic change. And it was the question was, should all senators stand for election? My co-chair and I submitted a request to the Wyoming Attorney General to give us some advice on that issue, Madam Chairman. The Attorney General provided a great letter. I believe it's even available on the website. We certainly have that available if anybody wants it. They basically said this is a question that remains in the legislature's prerogative. And the greatest aspect of the answer to the question was that, you know, our Constitution does provide that senators are elected for 4 years. And it is true that their districts have changed, but that change in their districts is a self-correcting change with regards to any voting issues, any places where a citizen may be disenfranchised, because perhaps they live in a district now where the boundary has changed and they did not have the opportunity to vote for that person that represents them in the Wyoming Senate. But the conclusion of the Attorney General was that that is a temporal distortion. It corrects itself in 2 years. That more damage is possibly done because the Constitution provides that senators stand for 4 years. And, you know, there's a reason. 4 years with staggered terms. And it's a reason that came about kind of following the organization of the United States Senate, where, of course, they have staggered terms of 6 years to contrast with the 2 year terms in the House of Representatives. We have a little bit similar thing with 4 years and 2 years, and probably if you read the writings about the Wyoming Constitution for a similar purpose. The idea is that senators are supposed to not be perhaps as concerned about popular feelings at the moment, and perhaps with their security of our wonderful longer terms, that we can look at things a little different. It's described in many writings as being things like where the House is the teacup, the Senate is the saucer that cools the tea. And you need both together to get to good policy. There's lots of writings like that. Definitely was something that our founding fathers who wrote the Wyoming Constitution thought about as they sat actually in room 302 discussed that very issue. Anyway, the committee looked at it. We discussed it. We ended up saying everybody gets to keep their terms, and that we will not shuffle the deck and have senators stand for election again, and that distortion is a 2-year temporal distortion in terms of issues with the voter. That was where the committee came out, major issue. And when the bill was finished by the committee during the interim, we did have a situation where one senator no longer resided in the district, or the proposed district. And the committee addressed that as well by saying that that senator should be allowed to remain and serve as a senator from that district And then at the next time there's an election, the senator could move back into the district or run for something else. But he would indeed follow the Wyoming Constitution and be able to serve out his term. That is a moot point at this time because the changes that were brought to the bill as you see it now kind of corrects that problem on its own. But I think that'll come back into discussion with the proposed amendment a little later on. We heard lots of testimony about the issues of counties. And there are some very influential representatives who worked very hard to advance what they called a county-based plan. We never received a complete plan developed to the detail that you can see in this from that proposal. But we put it up on the website in a different manner, more of a narrative, because we couldn't fit it into our mapping program. And the reason we couldn't, because no one ever developed a plan to the detail that it would be necessary to show like these. And we probably have 15 or 20 different versions of this plan when you consider the different regional ones, all developed to the detail of the census tracts. But the one plan that's often proposed, and we're going to hear more about it, as an alternative approach to redistricting in Wyoming, never was brought to the committee with that kind of detail that we could adopt it as a plan. And so, but we did put that out for public review on the website in a narrative format. But it was never developed to the detail with the staff time to go down and click on the voter districts to make it happen. And in fairness to the advocates of that plan, I believe that they were thinking that each regional area or combination of counties or standalone counties would develop a plan for themselves that would fit into it. But it never happened. There was never a groundswell elsewhere around Wyoming for that to happen. And as near as I can say, they were not able to impose that plan or get buy-in with that plan as across the state. So with that, Madam Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any more questions. We can move on to the amendments at the appropriate time.
Senator Bevo.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just a quick question under Article 3, Section 3, about the each county shall have at least one senator and one representative. Did you have some discussion about that? And how do you feel about it?
Senator Case.
Yes, Madam Chairman. Great question. We certainly had extensive question about that very issue. And that, of course, is the plan for organizing the Senate and the House representation that's prevailed in Wyoming until the court case where the decision, I believe, was issued in 1992. The Secretary of State at that time was Carpin. And the case is called, I'm going to use a proper name, I don't see why not, Gorin v. Carpin, whereby the state of Wyoming attempted to defend that very proposed plan and was unsuccessful in court. So that issue, and there's considerable discussion and reference in the court documents from that case, and we even have a legislative memo on that, that talks about the issues of what is the importance of county boundaries now. And the court, I'm going to read you a couple of things that were from the court. The Gorin decision goes to great length to specify the legislature's primary concern in redistricting the legislature must be the rights of individual Wyoming citizens, not the perceived entitlement of Wyoming counties. Here's some quotes from the case. While there can be little doubt that many Wyoming counties possess a sense of identity, a sense of neighborhood, and a sense of community interests, the bottom line is that citizens and not government units or regional interests are entitled to elect lawmakers. That's from that decision. Also, evidence as to the relative importance of counties is of little help to a court constitutionally bound to protect individual voting rights. Again, from that decision. Legislators represent people, not trees or acres. Citizens, not history or economic interests, cast votes. Counties do not stand on equal constitutional ground with citizens at the ballot box. A state's desire to construct districts along political subdivisions, i.e. counties, on county lines to ensure some voice to political subdivisions as political subdivisions, or to deter the possibility of gerrymandering, may be legitimate. However, neither history alone nor economic or other sorts of groups' interests are permissible factors in attempting to justify disparities from population-based representation. So what the court really did in that case is to come down squarely and say, it's sort of a nice idea, but we can't do it. And that's how we ended up with single-member districts and the whole possibility of keeping counties whole was eliminated with that case. That's not to mean to say that your committee didn't work hard and have as one of its principles the respect of county boundaries. And as you can see, as you look at these district lines, many of them do follow county boundaries where possible. But you know what? I admit it's pretty hard if you didn't have the other lines drawn on there that tells where the counties are, you couldn't tell where the counties are by looking at the district maps. But I think that's a direct consequence of the rulings of the court in this case. Our attorneys have continued to advise us that there is no way that we can recreate something along county boundaries. Now, Madam Chairman, there have been some fairly radical suggestions as we move forward, including weighted voting, where you take your smallest county, and if say every county had one senator, and then you would weight that senator's vote by the basis of the population of the county. Theoretically could work, maybe possibility. Another possibility, Madam Chairman, might be to revisit multi-member districts again, which even I've never really given up on, to be honest, and to look more about combinations of counties and representation. Let's see, another possibility is to expand the size of the legislature to have maybe 40 senators and maybe 80 House members. And then you could really possibly get at making sure counties, you know, your area of contention and the population would be smaller. You'd have a better chance of following county boundaries. All possibilities, some of which were considered by the committee, none of which appear to be engendering small support or large support. The conclusion, we've been with single-member districts now for 20 years. There seems to be an awful lot of momentum for single-member districts, for better or worse, both within these hollow chambers and within our citizenry. I think we're stuck, Madam Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Madam Chairman, I want to make a few comments. One is on the use of the county lines. The original district effort we put forth was really based on counties and aggregations of counties, like, for instance, the Bighorn Basin. And we really did try to follow county lines where we could. The math, you just can't work the math within the one-man, one-vote requirements as the courts have interpreted them. But I also wanted to say a few words about the whole process we went through. And I'd like to start out by complimenting the co-chairman of the committee. I think they did a marvelous job in working with all the various individuals, with working and particularly emphasizing everybody, we better work with the county clerks, and in listening to testimony all around the state and having an immense pool of patience in dealing with some of the suggestions we heard and some of the testimony we heard and handling some of the public meetings very well. So I'd like to compliment the co-chairman on the leadership they provided, and I'd like to compliment all the members that were involved in drawing the various individual plans with their respective clerks. I think we got a much better product doing it that way. And I'd particularly like to single out in the southwestern corner of the state, which was very contentious before and had that potential again, that two of our members, Senator Cooper and Senator Martin, spent inordinate amounts of time
going over with all the local officials and all the people involved again and again to develop a consensus plan that I think was the best that could be possibly done in that region. And it was duty well above and beyond the call of duty. The amount of work they put into it and the product was very good. And we saw that on a lesser scale all over the state. So, Mr. President, I've been involved in a number of these. This one was less contentious than many of the others. Partly it was luck we didn't have to make the kind of changes that caused tremendous heartburn. But a good part of it was the hard work on the part of the chairman, the individual members, and the county clerks in coming up with reasonable plans.
Senator Scott, have you moved Committee of the Whole number one?
I have not. I think I will yield to the good senator from Goshen County to bring that amendment. I do support the amendment.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, I move Committee of the Whole Amendment.
You have to read it in.
Oh, would you please read it in?
House Bill 32, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, to engross copy. In A.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, I move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 32, ask for your favorable consideration. Madam Chairman, this would have been in the standing committee, but my deputy clerk would have had to drive up on about 90 miles of a sheet of ice to get here to work on this, to get in front of the committee on time. So she came in Tuesday. We sat down for about 45 minutes of an hour. And we resolved all of her issues that she had. You should have a forwarded email to all of you that indicates your support of this amendment. What we did, and got it blown up right there. Interesting enough, the whole process which led us to this point on this amendment probably took place about 2 years ago when county clerks were certifying to the census, to the federal government, where the census blocks were. And four people got left out of the city of Torrington in that certification. So what we had to do was to bring in a big enough block of voters so their identity could be protected. And what to enable to do that, we dropped down and took in another precinct at Torrington so the ballot could be more equal. And the area that's was just highlighted, that's the precinct that we took in that was blue. The area that was previously highlighted was yellow, which was House District 5, and we just made that swap there. We also cleaned up some lines along the highway and the railroad track there. The clerk was very appreciative of that. That's a Potlatch trailer park, and there's always some confusion about which side of the highway or which side of the railroad track goes in which house district. We got that lined out, so she's in good shape about that. So with this, it clears it all up. I do want to express my appreciation to the committee. We kind of got started late in the process here. We are about the last ones at the dance, partly because we do have a deputy clerk, because our other clerk has had cancer and has probably only been on the job maybe 4 days in the last year. So the deputy clerk was pretty well pressed, couldn't be involved very much with this. But when we did get down here, the representatives and myself were able to get together and communicate and move forward on a plan that works for Goshen County. And with that explanation, Madam Chairman, I'd ask for the favorable consideration.
All those in favor of Senator Meyer's motion to adopt the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 32, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion to adopt that amendment has passed. Senator Case.
Madam Chairman, I would ask that the second Committee of the Whole Amendment be read in.
House Bill 32, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2, to engross copy in Attachment A.
Madam Chairman, I would move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2 to House Bill 32. Madam Chairman, what this amendment does is to return the bill to the, at least with respect to this part of Wyoming, to the status that it was before the amendment was offered to the east of us, which added this long strip that you're familiar with that encompasses our correctional facility at in the city of Torrington, and that would return that here. That is a subject of some debate with my good friends in this body, but and I'm bringing this personally. I don't mean to represent anything about the committee on this or anything about the other body. This is just Cale Case. I feel that that is the piece of our redistricting plan that perhaps is less satisfying to me in terms of being containing appropriate community of interest and really where we kind of went out of our way in a special circumstance, maybe or maybe not appropriate. And let me say in all good spirit, I'm not going to fight very hard for this. But to me, I'm very proud of the work that the committee did, and I'm very proud of how we got to where we were and the issues we took on. And I felt that this was the more appropriate way to leave this side of the county.
Senator Scott.
Madam Chairman, speaking on and against this particular amendment, Madam Chairman, it's no secret that this eastern edge and northeastern corner of the state were perhaps the most difficult set we dealt with, and we never did get a consensus plan from all the parties at interest in this particular area of the state, and eventually a member of the committee had to draw a plan that would meet the population criteria. We had a number of plans that either didn't meet the population criteria or that had major opposition from other parts of the area, and we had to do the best as a committee. The difficulty that you get into as you draw plans is that in a lot of Wyoming, the population is concentrated in the cities and towns. A lot of our rural areas just plain empty. So to get the population numbers to match, you often have to reach quite a distance. The Carbon County District is perhaps the most striking example of that. But in Goshen County, my understanding is what they really wanted to do was to keep as much of Goshen County into a single district as was possible. And hence the version that is in the bill as it stands before you with that border along the eastern side of the county that really is reaching up to grab the inhabitants of the prison because they don't vote, so they could care less whether they're in a district that is largely Laramie County or a district that's largely in Goshen County. And if you do that, you can put more of the citizens of Goshen County all into the one district, and it gives you a better representation for the people in Goshen County who can vote. And for that reason, I think the version that came on the House is probably a superior version than the bill as it stands now, and I think we ought to sustain it.
President Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think if I've learned anything in my years down here, I've learned to respect experience. And I think I just heard from the tall senator from Natrona County the voice of experience, and it's one that I think has certain appeal. However, I could not go without saying how much I respect the effort of the good chairman and what he's done throughout this whole process. I won't take a lot of time for explanation, but I would hope that you would defeat this amendment, given the voice of experience that you've heard, And it just as we laid the progress of this bill out, as it's made its way across the state to Cheyenne and in the incoming session, I was most impressed by the participation, the ownership, and the compromise along the way. And that explanation of compromise, be ever how large or how small, as we went into this process, led us to the point that we are now, and it just seems to me to adopt this amendment is a bit of a step backwards, and I would encourage you to resist the amendment. Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman. I think that I should stand up since this is very personal with me. That's part of my Senate district. And my good friend, the senior senator from Natrona County, said it all. Thank you.
Are you ready for the question?
Madam Chairman.
Senator Case.
Madam Chairman, before we do the question, I really don't want to speak to the characteristics. I'd like to have staff toggle back and forth between the two choices so everybody understands what we're voting on, and we'll get that done. So this is the proposed amendment, and as you see right here, and if we toggle back, this is the way it is now. So to be very clear, if you wish to remain like it is now, you should vote no to this amendment.
All those in favor of Senator Case's motion, Senator Burns.
Just for clarification's sake, when you go back to the other, toggle back to the other one? That's the way it is now in the bill. That's just for clarification's sake, that's not the way the current districts are. Just so I understand this.
Senator Case?
Madam Chairman, I certainly didn't mean to confuse. Right now, as the bill as amended by the House, it includes this long strip. And if you reject the amendment that's on the table right now, you maintain that right there.
All those in favor of Senator Case's motion to adopt the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
The Committee of the Whole Number 2 to House Bill Number 32 has failed.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Case.
I don't mean to represent that this is a perfect bill and that there's not contention. So perhaps this would be a good opportunity to answer questions about other proposals in other areas. Be happy to do so, and I know that there are other folks that would like to address this bill.
Senator Bebout.
Chairman, just a procedural question. We have the engrossed. It doesn't have the attachment A that's on the original bill that refers to it. Are we, in fact, if we're voting on the engrossed, do we have the attachment A that's similar to the one we see in 32 as originally presented, or are we consistent?
Senator Case.
Madam Chairman, we have a new attachment that encompasses that. We didn't reproduce the attachment because this is a very unusual bill in that there's the language that refers to attachments, but the attachments are really the districts. But there's a great amount of material. We can certainly get them for you if you want, but we did not cause that to be distributed. They're very little use when you're actually looking at the bill and trying to understand what happened. Without the computers, I think I can't imagine how you did it before computers, but that's what's made this an easy thing.
Are you ready for the Senator Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm going to be fairly brief. I'm not bringing any amendments, but I will tell you I think that the process was somewhat flawed on this. It left really a big hole in the Northeast that was totally unrepresented and really didn't have a good chance at a voice. Came to a lot of meetings. The way the committee was done, I'll read off to you kind of how it fell, and it's interesting. The top five counties, Laramie County had three on the committee. Natrona had three. Campbell had two. Sweetwater had one. Fremont had one. Albany had one. Sheridan had one. The 13 smallest counties did not have one seat on the corporations. And I'm telling you, it's really hard. Corporations is where this plan came from. It was exceptionally hard to come from a group that there's 13 counties that don't have one voice on the committee. They didn't have a chance to sit and help in the debate. You got to present. I presented five or six times. It's pretty hard to do it. It's not fun to stand here and tell you that. But I'm telling you, that's how it worked. And it left it where a big chunk of the Northeast was left totally disenfranchised by the way the committee operated. I would suggest we look at changing it in the future. I realize how it's going to happen. We came out of it with a pairing that I am going to end up representing one of the richest counties in Wyoming. At the same time, I represent one of the poorest counties. And for any of you that really know what community interests are, it's dang hard. I listen to the debate every day down here. It's going to be pretty hard to go home when you've been working for one of the bigger counties that's well-to-do and go to one of the poorest counties and explain to them what you've done and come through it. This process left all of the big counties wholly intact, able to vote in all of their people within their boundaries, i.e. they have their county blocks intact, at the expense of the small counties. We're the ones that took the cut. If you look at Weston County, they're very likely going to come out of this down the road with no senator and no house person. And they're a county that basically has very close to the population to be able to at least have a house person in it. But because of the way that this body's chosen to split them, they're going to leave that county totally taken apart. One of the poorest counties, and they got no voice. The biggest community of interest you had in the state was the district I represent, and it was torn apart. So I really encourage you to think really hard about some type of bill or some type of work which I may bring that makes this process more fair for the small counties next time. Because I'm telling you, when you look at this, they got left out. They didn't have a chance. And without a voice on that committee, it is very, very hard to get anywhere. Thank you.
President Anderson.
Thank you. Just for the record, I stand before you as president of the Senate, and I made these appointments. I would just like you to understand that my home county is divided three ways. And if I were to run again, the Senate district would not only have three divisions in my home county, but it would encompass two counties. The idea that there was any protection on the part of my home county, I don't, that doesn't hold. Commerce County divided three ways. Thank you. And I have no complaint.
Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Case's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 32, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 32 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 10.
House Bill 10, sponsored by Representative Mooney's Game and Fish Additional Elk Licenses and Acts Relating to Game and Fish. It was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Dockstader, Driscoll, and Esquivel. Senator Burns, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Burns.
Oh, Madam Chair, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on on House Bill 10, Game and Fish Additional Elk Licenses. There are no standing committee amendments on this bill. And for a further discussion of the bill, I would ask that you call on Senator Emmerich.
Senator Emmerich.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. The explanation of why this bill arose would take much time, and I'll try to be simple. Several constituents from Albany and Laramie County drew to the attention of the Agriculture Committee the increased amount of damage by elk that are along the Laramie Peak Range between Laramie and Cheyenne. These landowners are suffering from too many elk, as are several other areas of the state. And we were asking, how can we deal with this damage? As we progressed, we found that it was a much larger situation than just too many elk in a small area of the state. We were talking about relations of game and fish with landowners and back and forth, and that doesn't need to really enter into this bill. But in the progress of discussion, we asked Game and Fish, what can we do to help you manage elk in a better way? We had several bills proposed concerning harvesting of cow elk before you could harvest bull elk, et cetera, et cetera. But what finally came down, the easiest, simplest way, was to remove the prohibition in statute on the number of elk licenses that could be issued to a single person. It's the only big game animal that has a limit set in statute, and that's two. And so I'm asking, as the bill, really, the meat of the bill is on page two. We are striking line three through line six. Additional elk licenses under this subsection shall be restricted to allowing any one hunter to take a maximum of two elk in a season under all licenses held. What this does is places the restrictions, if any, the number of licenses, if any, to the Game and Fish Commission and let them do their job, as they do with all other species. So this is actually, I don't know how much this will help, but it's a beginning. I think we will harvest more cow elk out of this area and in other areas of the state, and possibly we will reduce some of the depredation. It's an area and a thought process that needs to go forward for the next year or years to eliminate some of these problems. But for the time being, we think that this will help the Game and Fish to harvest more elk in the state in areas that are impacted by what we think to be overpopulation. I'll stand to answer any questions. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Madam Chairman, and with some trepidation do I rise on a Game and Fish issue. The concern we're starting to see among the sportsmen in my county, Madam Chairman, is that a few wealthy individuals are buying up vast tracts of land and just locking it up, really, as private hunting preserves. And it's not always motivated by hunting. A lot of the motivation for the purchase of the land is economic. It'll hold its value in an inflation. But you get it bought, and the next thing that happens is they put up a no trespassing sign and a manager to enforce it. And the question I've got regarding this bill is for those that are trying to do that to create their own private hunting preserve, does this bill give them aid and comfort by enlarging the number of licenses that they and a few of their select friends can get? Because if so, I know a lot of my constituents are going to feel mightily offended, Madam Chairman. So I want a little reassurance that this doesn't reinforce that tendency.
Senator Burns.
Madam Chair, the purpose of this bill is an exact reaction to the very problem that the good senator is referring to. There are large tracts of lands being locked up, and you've got, in some cases, semi-absentee owners who have a different theory of preservation and management, wildlife management than Game and Fish does, and that most of us do. And what has happened as a result of that is some gunshots will go off somewhere and the animals will come onto their property. They don't allow hunting. And then once hunting season is over, then they go back off the property and start feeding on other people's property. That's where we're running into the problem. And this is in reaction to that, so they can control the harvests on, and in some cases where it's needed, increase the harvest on these animals. Most of the permits we're talking about are for cow elk. So the idea of trophy hunters really doesn't enter this particular equation.
Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 10, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill number 10 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 25. The reading clerk will read the House Bill.
House Bill number 25, sponsored by Representative Stubson, Private Transfer Fee Obligation, an act relating to real property. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Perkins. Senator Perkins, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Perkins?
Madam Chairman, I move that when the committee whole rise to report, that it is so with a do pass recommendation for House Bill 25. And for an explanation of the bill, I ask that you would call upon, actually, before we do that, if I may, there is a standing committee amendment, I believe. Mm-hmm. I thought there was.
Yes, there is.
I would ask that that be read in at this time.
The reading clerk will read in the amendment.
House Bill 25, Standing Committee Amendment, Amendment Number 1 to engross copy, page 4, line 18.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Perkins.
I move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 25, and for an explanation of the bill and the amendment, I ask that you would call upon the good senator from Fremont County, Senator Bebout.
Senator Bebout.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Bebout.
I'll yield to my tall colleague from Natrona County.
Senator Scott.
Madam Chairman, I'll explain the bill briefly, but then I would like the Standing Committee amendment to explain what it did to the bill. Madam Chairman, the bill comes to you because there's a practice that's starting to develop where people who are selling land in an area that they think it's going to greatly appreciate, particularly up in Teton County, are starting to say, well, if what we'll do is put a provision in that every time it changes hands, money comes back to us. We get a cut, a percentage, if you will. And frankly, that's a bad practice in economic terms. It's what you would call unproductive rent seeking. It doesn't add anything to the value of the process. It just puts an encumbrance on. And if you keep the percentage relatively small, that doesn't make any difference. The buyer, the original buyer and the seller aren't motivated to prevent it. It happens, and then you have this periodic payment whenever properties change hands. that goes back to an original owner who's long since out of the picture, and you have all kinds of opportunities for mischief. Realtors have been strongly opposed to the practice, and they're one of the organizations that are pushers behind this bill. The federal government is starting to say if you've got one of these encumbrances, it restricts our ability to lend with the federal lenders or to guarantee with the federal lenders. And it really doesn't add any particular economic benefit to the whole real estate transaction process, and it adds lots of opportunities for trouble. Is it owed when you have an intra-family sale that's below market? What are the possibilities there? How do you find some of these people if a long period of time passes? It's just an infinite opportunity for mischief, Madam Chairman. And basically what the bill does is very simple. It prohibits it, you can see that on page 6, lines 1 through 6. And most of the, then some recording requirements, because we've had a few of them already occur, and we want to at least give people notice. And the rest of it is making exemptions so that we don't interfere with things that do make sense in the ordinary flowing of commerce. Madam Chairman, that's a brief explanation of the bill, and I would yield to the Standing Committee to explain their amendment.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and I apologize for the circular nature of our handoffs today. The purpose behind the Standing Committee Amendment was in a certain part of the state which seems to be particularly adverse to the hedonic wage index. There have been a number of instances. There's been some land trusts and some other people who, as a part of some development transactions, have applied what probably I think could be construed as a private transfer fee obligation to assist in a number of things that they deem beneficial to their community, such as I believe there's some development right issues. There's some that come back and help fund some mass transportation and some other things like that. And anyway, that area of the state's found it very helpful. It's limited to, and I don't know that it happens necessarily on the transfers, but it does happen on the transfers, but also some annual assessments and other things like that. So it's a little horse of a, it appeared to be a horse of a little bit different color, something that's working well in a part of the state, and you know, God bless them if they found solutions to some of their problems. As that amendment was brought forth, there was no opposition to that amendment in the committee. And so what we did is we added this to limit it to a, what we did on page 4, on line 18, we added the language which is in doing some of the things that are defined as not transfer, private transfer fees. So on line 4, line 18, we inserted the words, to a nonprofit land trust. In line 14, we also made it so it's limited to a nonprofit land trust, and which is the holders of those things now. With that kind of exempts out those individuals and allows them to continue in their current practice. And they indeed seem to derive some economic benefit out of that for their community. And in doing so, then the other thing that it is on page 6, line 12, went back and, on page 6, line 12, we went back and also exempted it out there when it says when you insert after the 2012, insert the words or an obligation under WS 2428101A2G, which refers back to this nonprofit organization. So it's a very tight exception for these nonprofits. As I said, there was no opposition to it that appeared in committee. And with that, we'd ask for your favorable recommendation and favorable approval of Senate or Standing Committee Amendment number 1. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 25, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That amendment has passed. Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And one other important part of this bill is on page 6, and there's a trigger date, April Fool's Day of 2012. And so if you're before it, you're treated a certain way, and if you're after it, you're treated a certain way. And if it occurs after it, then it is not binding to include that in your title on your real property. And if it occurs before it, you have to record a notice in the courthouse and then clearly identify that disclosure. So I really think it tries to protect people before and after the effective date of this. So I think that's an important part of the bill.
The reading clerk will read in the Committee of the Whole number 1.
House Bill 25, Committee of the Whole, Amendment Number 1 to engrossed copy, page 2, line 9.
Senator Scott.
Madam Chairman, I move adoption of Committee of the Whole, Amendment Number 1. And, Madam Chairman, let me explain why we do these things. In the course of my work in Committee 10, I work with a lot of federal legislation, and it is technically awful. It's hard to understand. It's all over the place in terms of how they write it. It's duplicative. It tends to be a mess, and that is quite in contrast with the quality of work that this legislature and many other legislatures produce. And one of the reasons is that we've developed a good set of drafting standards, and the members enforce the drafting standards. And that's what this amendment does, Madam Chairman. The drafting standards discourage the use of the word such, and frankly, I was trained in this by the real master at that, who was Representative Hansen. And it really is important that we continue to keep ours clean and understandable. This is just a small piece of that. But what this amendment does, Madam Chairman, is to desuchify this bill. I urge its adoption.
Question on the desuchification.
All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion to adopt the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 25, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That standing or Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 25 has passed. We are back on the bill. Senator Schiffer.
Madam Chairman, I'm really struggling with why we're addressing this issue. As I understand it, somebody owns a piece of ground, and they've decided that they're going to sell it. And they structure a deal, and they find a willing buyer, and they're a willing seller. It's a deal between two people. And I'm trying to figure out what the state's interest is in coming in and saying there are certain things that you cannot negotiate in a sale of land, of private property. And I'm missing that. Can somebody please tell me what is the state's interest in forbidding them to negotiate private transfer fee obligations? I just don't understand intruding into private property rights in this manner. I'm missing something with this bill, obviously.
Senator Scott.
Let me see, Madam Chairman, if I can explain, because I had the same kind of question when this first came up a few years ago, and it's taken me a while to get my mind around what's going on and why. The difficulty you get into with private transfer fees, one, you have the practical difficulty. If you do that, the feds then restrict downstream some of your borrowing opportunities because they don't want to deal with it when they lend and take an interest in the property or guarantee a loan. So that's a practical reason. The second reason is that there isn't sufficient interest. The harm that's done, put it this way, is as you get 40, 50, 100 or more years downstream, and you have a piece of property that hasn't sold, and all of a sudden it does, and this private transfer fee kicks in, and you have increasing difficulties with time figuring out who gets that. It has the potential for giving you a real mess down the road that will cloud titles all over the place, that will cause injustices where you find some of the people that are due the transfer fee, but gosh, the family lost track of half. You know, they have a family and they don't know where to even look to find who gets a fee. It is a mess that can cloud titles long term all over the state. And the question then comes to my mind, what economic good does the thing do? And I suppose you could amend it and say, okay, we'll allow them for some set period of time where we probably will know who gets them. Then you have a cutoff problem with a cliff right at the edge of whenever that time expires. But there isn't much incentive in terms of the buyer of the property to reject this whole private transfer fee. It isn't going to bother him much. The evil comes a good deal later. So we're likely to see a proliferation of these things that will long-term cloud titles and make the ability to transfer and sell and do sensible things with real estate difficult. Probably not for our generation, but for our kids and our grandkids' generation, where you get these things that they were hung on back in year 2000, and it's now 2150 or something like that. And who are these people? Who gets it? Is it going to be enforced? Is it going to be ignored? You can see all the problems for long-term mischief. And I think, Madam Chairman, that's what the state's interest is in prohibiting these. It doesn't do any short-term good, and it does long-term considerable harm.
Senator Beavout.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And I think my tall colleague makes a good point, but let's talk about just in the short term as well. And if you go buy a piece of property and you get your title opinion, and the private, whatever might have happened, may not be included in that, and then you buy that property, and after you purchased it down the road, in a certain period of time, you get a notice that, well, by the way, there's a transfer fee that you're supposed to pay to me. Well, your title opinion never saw that. It was never disclosed. So there you have a situation that's really it's just not fair to the buyer. And so what this bill does is time specific, and I talked about April 1st of 2012. And if a private transfer fee obligation is imposed prior to April 1st of 2012, then you have to file a notice of that private transfer fee obligation in the office of the clerk of court. And other things have to be done. And then if you don't do that, then no court, if you go over on page 7, no court in the state of Wyoming shall have jurisdiction to enforce it unless they've done this. So as of that date, anything that's out there kind of in nowhere land, you have to notify it. Now, if you go forward, then there's those exemptions that don't include it in the bill. You know, a realtor's fee, you know, all those different kinds of, it starts on page 2 and goes through all through line 6. So you really have a time. So I think it takes care of those in the past by saying you have to file it. So if you buy property in the future, you're aware of it. And if it's not filed and you're not aware of it, then there's no obligation you have to pay it. And for moving forward, you've got the list of exemptions that will not be included. So I think it really takes care of all the situations.
Senator Hines.
Madam Chairman, I do have a problem with this type of a state involvement in private transfer. It's been before this legislature before, and I just, you know, I hear just a very, the only time I ever hear of it is when a bill come up. And while I haven't been here 120 years, the state have been here 120 years, and the sponsor and I have been here quite a few years. But where do we stop? Right now, if you own mineral rights, you can reserve a percentage of them. Other things you can sell and reserve a percentage that goes on forever. I go out and buy a bull. The seller of that bull will retain an interest in him until he dies. And I have the choice. I can either buy him or not. So this kind of looked the same to me. Why should the state be restricting private agreements? If people don't like it, they don't buy it.
Senator Perkins.
Chairman, one of the reasons that the state has in the state has an interest in prohibiting private citizens from restricting the alienability of property. And what that means is the state has an interest in ensuring that property can be transferred between willing buyers and willing sellers. And we do that quite often as we define in state law, we define what those property rights are. And we define restrictions and limitations on those property rights. We've done that before. In the last couple sessions, you might remember when we defined what poor spaces were. It's a similar thing. We defined what that right is. A session or two ago, we defined wind rights and wind agreements and what those were. We identified them as part of the surface estate, and that those were interests in real property and required that they be filed. And one of the reasons we do that is because we need to be very careful, because the state law and the state defines what those property rights are. We defined, and you've heard this before as we talk about this bundle of sticks and property rights. You know, your property right is akin to a bundle of sticks. One of those is the ability to use it. One of those is the ability to lease it out. Another is the ability to sell it. Another is you have all those bundles of rights that come into these things. And what happens when you allow these private transfer fee obligations in an unlimited nature is you create a burden or a drag on the ability to convey that property freely onto the future. Now, the difference between real estate and bulls, and I'm not a rancher, but even I know the difference between real estate and bulls. But bulls are like Doritos; you can make more. But land, there's only so much of it, and so the state has always retained an ability or an interest in making sure that there's free saleability and transferability of that property among its citizens and residents. And going back to that, when you do that in this state, one of the ways you do that is you show that you have what is called marketable title. You're able to convey that property freely to somebody who buys it. You do that right now through title opinions. In Wyoming, that's how you convey it. Other states, you may have an attorney that goes out and does an abstract or something like that. But the way that if you've got an agreement, and most of them will, that requires that you be able to present marketable title at closing, you do that by providing a title opinion or title commitment that ensures or warranties that title. One of the things that you'll find here is that private transfer fees that the underwriters of title policies will refuse to warrant property that have these things on them. If they have them, they will not warrant that, and that makes you as a buyer later on unable to sell your property. And so that's where the state has an interest, is not in getting in the middle of that transaction, but ensuring that property can be sold by you and by your heirs or by whoever you assign it to or sell it to later on, that they can sell it again. And then if you have this open and unrestricted, you get down, if the good senator in front of me, if he were to sell me property and retain a transfer interest fee in that, that's fine. I hold it for 60 years, and then I go sell it. Who knows where who knows where the good senator in front of me is at that point in time, or his kids? How do we find that out? And ultimately what you end up doing is probably paying this down to the Secretary of State, the Lost Property Division, and it just creates a continuing drag on this property and makes it less desirable. And that's the state's interest. You may or may not agree with that, but ultimately that's the idea behind it.
and we have to be careful about doing this. I would just remind this body that just a year ago in this, we brought a bill to do away with the rule against perpetuities, and this body argued about that very same thing. It's a very analogous situation, and decided that no, that was a restriction that we didn't want to impose. We thought that we didn't want to do away with the rule against perpetuities, which has the same kind of thing. It's the ability of the state says, no, at a certain point, these things, these trusts, these events are not going to be valid any longer, and this is much the same in that same vein. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Senator Nicholas.
Madam Chairman, I just heard that explanation. You know, for hundreds of years, we've been not had this issue or this problem. And, you know, I guess I'm still not understanding the issue. In general, there are all kinds of property principles. You don't get to keep an interest in generally property unless you keep an ownership of the property. One's a license that expires. There's all kinds of laws that says if you want to keep an interest, it has to be recorded. If it's not recorded, subsequent folks your interest gets terminated by a bona fide purchaser for value. And my concern of this deal is, first of all, if we're going to redraft our statutes, our property law statutes, because title companies don't want to insure things because they see a risk or a boogeyman that doesn't exist, then I can tell you that you can go through a title insurance policy and about 15 or 20 things that are simply shouldn't be there. Now, we oftentimes go in and negotiate those restrictions off. So I guess we shouldn't be changing our property laws because title insurance companies choose or not to choose to take risk. And we have all kinds of protections. And now what you create is a statute that has a whole bunch of exceptions. So you go look and say, well, as long as I'm in this, then it doesn't apply. And from a title examination, that in itself creates a nightmare. I guess I'm hearing the explanation. I'm still not seeing what the real problem is that the property law for 100 years hasn't resolved. And it sure doesn't seem to me that title insurance companies should be governing our title work.
Senator Driscoll.
Madam Chairman, thank you. This is no less an out and out assault on private property rights. You know, we all are property owners in here. When you transfer property, you're allowed to do virtually anything you want in the contract. You do it and you register at the courthouse. And that's the arguments you have that you can't find them, you can't see them. You know, we've dug and tried to find 256 mineral rights around. I had a neighbor bought a ranch that had to find 7 or 8 heirs that owned 130 seconds. We have a process to fix that. If you've got things that you can't find, you can't figure out where it goes to, we've got a process. It's all in law, be able to do it. You need to leave private property owners with the ability to do what they want to do with their property. And, you know, this really is just keeps chipping away. You keep saying, yeah, you can own it. We'll tax it for you. We'll tell you how to do it. We'll tell you what to do. And each step you do that, I'm telling you, if you think this is restrictive, each time you do one of these, it makes it tougher to sell a place. And we as buyers and we as sellers decide what it did to the value. You're absolutely correct. It will devalue a property to put this on there. It might make or buy the neighbor's ranch cheaper because it's got a transfer tax. We've got sophisticated buyers and sellers in this country. And they understand when they look at the title, if you didn't find it, it's your own fault. We all know how it works. The contracts are generally stated in a way that you're covered on it. You buy the title insurance. If the guy's junked the place up, if it's covered with a mess, you probably bought it for a song. The same thing's true with this. If the guy's put 30 different restrictions on the title, somebody's going to come in and steal it because he devalued it. And each time that you do this, you devalue it. But it's your choice to devalue it, not someone else's. And that's really, we've got to really protect ourselves, that we leave ourselves as landowners with every possible right with that title to the property that we got when we got the ground. It's your choice to do it, not the government's to restrict it from you. And we really shouldn't be wandering down this alley. Another year or two, we're going to be coming back and saying, well, what if this happens? This guy, it might devalue his ranch if he ran cows on it. Maybe we shouldn't be letting him run cows because it's going to make it worth less money. Let's leave us with our full bundle of sticks, people. Thank you.
Senator Bevoud.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Nobody is more concerned about private property rights than me. I'm going to buy a piece of property, and there's some kind of a private transfer fee on there that I don't know about, and I buy it, and I find out later that it's happened. How is that affecting my private property rights in a negative way? I don't understand the argument about the private property rights. This is a transfer fee. This isn't, if I want to sell an undivided interest in my property, and I disclose that up front, I'm only selling 50%, it's undivided, you know that when you sell the property. But if I have someone that I bought the property from 10 years ago to put a fee on there that I'm not aware of, it doesn't occur in the title opinion, so I don't know about it, and the title opinion isn't worth the paper it's written on a lot of times, so I'm stuck out there all by myself, not knowing about it, and then I turn around and try to sell it later, and it turns up later, then how is that fair to the subsequent buyer or to me? And as I read this bill, and what I thought we were trying to do here is very carefully delineate that so it's recorded. And if you look at the language in here, as of that trigger date on April 1st, you know, if you've done it before and it's included, you've got to go ahead and record it so people down the road understand that. If it happened afterwards, you have to do the same thing, and it's included in the title change. So what I think we're trying to do is provide that protection. Now, I'm not an attorney. I'll yield to my colleague, but as a private property right, that's why I like this bill, so I'll know what I'm buying and I'll have access to what's happened to it and what's happened in the past. So I don't make decisions based on what someone else might have done that I was not aware of. So I think that protects me as a buyer or seller. And if I'm wrong, then my tall colleague and I shouldn't probably be on this bill.
Senator Nicholas?
I guess my question is, I mean, does anybody believe that an agreement that's not recorded is binding on anybody? Right? For the folks that work the bill, as far as I know, if it's not recorded of record and you buy the property and you don't know it, it's not binding on you. That's the way the law's always been.
Senator Schiffer?
Question for the sponsors. Was there any discussion, rather than the prohibition, that go in on page 6 and say if you're going to have, you put the requirements under 3428103 on any real property transaction that has one of these fees attached, you put it on the deed, and then everybody knows about it, but you're not restricting our ability to negotiate one. Was there any discussion in the committee about that, or did anybody contemplate being that radical?
Senator Scott?
Madam Chairman, I was not on the committee that dealt with that this year, so I can't tell you. I don't recall when it was before was here, a particular discussion in committee on that sort of thing, because that doesn't solve the problem of having this encumbrance that goes on forever where you lose track of who's entitled to the fee, an encumbrance that really is a dead hand in the future on your ability to trade real property. And I will say, Madam Chairman, I have seen this in the mineral rights area where we are gradually developing a problem that I think our successors are going to have to deal with someday. One of our neighboring ranches severed its mineral rights, and it turns out there's an oil prospect there, but it's not worth enough to go through and find, and it's an expensive process, can be, once people get lost, find who really owns that. And the result is it's going to sit there undeveloped for years and years and years and maybe forever because it's got this encumbrance on it. And I think this has the possibility, if we don't put a stop to these private transfer fees, it's got the possibility of doing that sort of thing long term to a lot of real estate. It just gets too expensive to deal with it. So I think it's a very practical matter, both in terms of you may not like what the title companies are doing, but they're doing it, And I don't know how you stop that. They're saying, you know, you got one of these things, we just don't want to do business there. You can't really force people to do business. So that's a very practical consideration why you need this bill. The mess that you're getting the state into long term is the other reason you need this bill. And I would say we've had property law in the state for all these years, but the creativity of man in economic rent seeking never ceases to amaze me. And this is a new wrinkle that has been discovered, and frankly, I think has the possibility for doing considerable damage to our state long term if we don't nip it in the bud while it's still confined just to a small corner of the state. So I think for all those reasons, it is wise for us at this point to say, no, we are simply not going to allow these, the few that have already happened, they've got to record them. The people in the business don't seem to have quite as firm a view on the property law as some others have as to whether or not these things are enforceable long term if they're not recorded.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question to the sponsor or the presenter. When you go through and it says private transfer fee shall not include the following, and you go through this great big list, what's left?
Senator Scott.
Madam Chairman, what's left is the pure private transfer fee that says if you sell this property down the road, whether it's 10 years or your heirs 100 years from now, you owe me 5% of the value. That's what's left, and that's what's prohibited, and that's what will cause the trouble. The exemptions are the kind of economic activities where a temporary situation makes considerable sense.
All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 25, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
I'm not sure the outcome of that vote. All of those in favor, please rise. Those opposed, please rise. House Bill 25 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration. Oh, excuse me. Majority Floor Leader, Senator Ross.
Madam Chairwoman, I move that the Senate stand at ease for the purposes of a 5-minute break.
All of those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. We are recessed. I'm fine. Just like this. Thank you. I'm used to drinking a little bit warm water.
Thank you.
House Bill 29, sponsored by the Minerals Committee, Uranium Research Center Funds Extension, and Act Relating to Abandoned Mine Land Funds. It was referred to Committee Number 9, Mineral Business and Economic Development. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cole, Cooper, Jennings, and Rothfuss. Senator Bebout, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Bebout?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, I the committee of the whole rise and report to do so with the recommendation that House Bill 29 do pass. There are no standing committee amendments, and I yield to the floor sponsor of the bill, Senator Jennings.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Hopefully this will be easier. If you look at the fiscal note, that's the bill. Basically what we did is back in '09, we put up $1.6 million of AML money to the be administered through the Energy School for the uranium research. There's several projects that were awarded grants. There's some underway right now. So out of the appropriation, $250 has been awarded, $750 has been committed, and there's about $580 out there that could have gone through the process and been awarded, but the problem that would have been would have come from that is that by the time the project would have been completed, the sunset date on the whole thing would have been passed. So rather than going through that process and committing monies that might fall into the sunset, they held that portion of money, the 580, back. There's plenty of projects in the queue to go for it, to look at a lot of the in-situ uranium and some of the reclamation that goes on with that. And so what they're asking is that we go to, in the bill, the only change is on page 2, line 11, to extend the reversion of 2013 to 2015, and then that way they can take a look at these projects that are sitting in the queue. The thing about it is they could have committed to those projects, but the council didn't think that was the proper thing to do if we couldn't commit it and complete it by the 2013. So I'd ask, stand for any questions, and I'd ask for your favorable vote on this little bill.
All those in favor of Senator Bebout's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation for House Bill 29, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 29 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 36. The reading clerk will read the House bill.
House Bill 36, sponsored by Representative Wallace, Paramutual Permits, an Act Relating to Paramutual Events. It was sent to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Dockstader, Driscoll, and Escobel. Senator Burns, Chairman.
Senator Burns.
Madam Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 36, Paramutual Permits. There are no standing committee amendments, and for a further explanation of the bill, I ask that you call on the good senator from District 22.
Senator Schiffer.
Madam Chairman, just a brief history. Madam Chairman will recall over the last couple years, we've been trying to nurture and grow the horse industry in Wyoming. It was once a very vibrant industry, scattered around the state at Evanston, and I'm just naming a few, Thermop, Casper. They ran live race meets, and local people participated with their horses, and it was a going industry. The way it was set up, in order to get the ability to run simulcasting, which is what finances the industry, you needed to run live races. And that's what builds a horse industry within the state. What this bill does is add some stability to that industry. Instead of only issuing the permits to operate live races and subsequently the simulcasting, it used to be limited to a one-year permit. What this bill does is says your racing commission can issue them for 3 years so that people that raise horses and get them ready to go to a track will know I have a three-year window. It will operate for 3 years. That's all it does. It doesn't expand doesn't change any of the basic structure, but it's intended to provide some stability. Up until a year ago, there was no live racing. The racetrack over at Evanston was owned by an investor from out of state. Last year, some people came in and operated live racing in Rock Springs at their fairgrounds. Since that time, those same people, and they are natives of Wyoming, that have come back, they bought the track in Evanston. Their intent is to try and have live racing there again. I don't know if they'll accomplish that, but at the very least, they anticipate having live racing at the fairgrounds in Rock Springs. This says, okay, you'll have at least a three-year window. If you get that track up and running, you'll have the contract for up to 3 years. It's permissive. The Racing Commission will look at it and say, yes, we're comfortable with a three-year window. I'd be happy to try and answer any questions.
All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 36, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 36 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 52.
Senate File 52, sponsored by Representative Stubson, Private Road Actions Appraisal Cost and Acts Relating to the Establishment of Private Roads. House Bill 52?
Didn't I say that?
I thought I did. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Perkins. Senator Perkins, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Perkins?
Madam Chairman, I move that with the Committee of the Whole rise to report that do so with a favorable do pass recommendation on House Bill 52, Private Road Actions, Appraisal Cost. And for an explanation of the bill, I ask that you would call upon the good senator from that anti-hedonic wage index county of Teton.
Senator Christensen.
Anti. Thank you, Madam Chairman. House Bill 52 addresses an issue of concern. If you look at the, let's go right to the bill and the language first. At the bottom of page 1, line 13 down to the end. In addition to paying other damages and costs required by this section, the applicant shall be responsible for paying the reasonable costs of an appraisal obtained by an affected party if that appraisal was adopted in a substantial part as a basis for damages and varied more than 15% from the valuation determined by the viewers and appraisers. Having been involved in a couple different of these matters, private road actions, what this amendment really does, or this bill does, is to offer some protection and a way. So if the party that the affected party so feels that their the appraisal is off, is too low, they can go out and get their own. And if it comes back within that 15 or above that 15% difference and is accepted, that they can be made whole on that. It's one of these deals where it's tough on the parties involved. You have the applicant, you have the affected party, and quite often there are a lot of questions and concerns about this. And this is just a check and balance to give the affected party some peace of mind, and if they so feel, they can go out and do their work. And if they do find out that the viewers and appraisers came in with the first appraisal and are off the mark, they can ask for a remedy. The viewers and appraisers on this, it's important to note, are not necessarily, I think is the language. So this just gives a voice. It's a mechanism that helps protect and offer some assurances to the affected parties. I'd stand for question.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. So is this a situation where the county is asking someone to help them with a private road, or is it a transaction between two separate parties? And who is the affected party? Is it? What about condemnation? Is that part of this at all?
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. To kind of help a little bit with that, I was one of the co-sponsors on this bill also, although my name does not show up on it. For some reason, there was some glitch. but this is when you have a piece of landlocked land, and you're looking for a way to get into it from a road, and you have the ability to go to your county commission and petition them to assign viewers and appraisers to see if they will recommend a possible road entry into that over another person's piece of land. And when they do that, they also are able to appraise that piece of ground that's being used for that 30-foot allowable right-of-way. And what this says is that is like as the good senator from Teton says, a lot of times, these people that are non-affected parties go out there, they're appointed as appraisers and viewers. They have no experience, basically, most of the time in appraising land and so forth. And so they may judge this land to be worth $1,000. Well, the affected party says, wait a minute now, I think it's worth a little more than that. And they can go and get an appraiser and take it to the county commission, or if the county commission sees fit to, they can actually move it up to the district court, and the judge can also make a decision on this too. And if that judge or that commission uses that appraisal of that affected party in the judgment, then that's fine. They will get paid that amount of money. They may say it's worth $8,000. The other one say it's worth the original viewer said it's worth $1,000. But if that judgment, if that's used in the judgment, that appraisal value of $8,000, then this allows them to get paid for the appraisal. They would have gotten the $8,000 anyway, but this allows them to then recover their money for that appraisal if it is more than 15% above the original viewer's estimate. And that's how this thing works.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, I'd agree with the good senator from the other side of the state if that's what the bill actually said, but it doesn't say 15% above. It says varies by 15%. So I think that'd be a great second reading amendment if you go in and put 15% above, unless I missed something there. Because I thought there was just a deviation of 15%. Maybe I missed something.
Senator Cole.
Being from one of those pro-hedonic school districts, if I understand this correctly, if you have somebody that's landlocked, and I did the same thing that the good senator did here, I was a commissioner for 8 years, and you appoint the viewers and appraisers, and you have an applicant, and, this applicant is the one that has a piece of land that's probably landlocked, and I got to cross somebody's land to get there. Do I understand that that applicant, if there's a variation of 15%, there's an automatic appraisal that comes into play here, if I understand that correctly. and the applicant has to pay, the applicant that's crossing somebody else's land has to pay for that appraisal. Is that correct?
Senator Cooper?
Madam Chairman, the if I understand the question correctly, there is not an automatic, there is an appraisal effect that takes place when the viewer and appraisers are appointed by the commission. That is correct. But there is not an automatic thing that comes into play that says you have to go out and hire a professional appraiser at this point. That's up to the affected party, not the applicant. You know, the applicant could probably do it if they wanted to, but it would, there'd be no reason. But the affected party, that means the party that's being affected by the road going across their piece of land, if they go out and get an appraisal then, and it varies, and like, that's a good point, about by 15%, then they get paid for that. There's something, by the way, Madam Chair, we may want to take a look on a second reading amendment if this thing passes to look at that word varies in there. Thank you.
Senator Christensen.
Madam Chairman, in the example went through at home, the viewers and appraisers were appointed by the county commission. And so it was you had to find people who'd volunteer their time. And we did, we went through that a couple of times, and we had outcomes going both directions on it. But as far as the amendment, there's a two-part really test here, that the appraisal was adopted in substantial part as a basis for damages. This is the first one, and two is more than 15% above. And as far as changing it, as we looked a little bit closer, if the affected party goes out and gets an appraisal and find out it's lower, they're probably not going to submit that appraisal because it isn't in their best interest. And so, you know, they have that option. And so I'm not sure that we have to change the wording. It's a good thought, but it may be unnecessary on that one. But it's a good bill, and it offers protection, and it offers a voice. It's to the affected parties, so the people that are looking to have their land crossed. It's an emotional time when they're being forced by the government to give up an easement. And so I think this is very important. It's a good bill, and I'd ask for your support.
All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation for House Bill 52, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 52 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 8. The reading clerk will read House Bill 8.
House Bill 8, sponsored by the Labor Committee, Department of Workforce Services Consolidation, an act relating to the administration of government. It was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services. The report's back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Dockstader, Martin, Nutting, Schiffer, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Scott?
Chairman, I move in the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with a recommendation that House Bill 8 do pass. There was no standing committee amendment, and I yield to Senator Dockstader for an explanation of this good little House bill.
Senator Dockstader.
Madam Chair, House Bill 8, Department of Workforce Services Consolidation. It addresses the consolidation of the Department of Employment with the Department of Workforce Services. This is part of the interim topics. House Bill 8 looks over all the boards within the Department of Health. Some were formed statutorily, some through the governor, some by federal mandate. It addresses the consolidation or elimination, specifically if the council or commission, or the board in this instance, is no longer required as a condition for receiving federal funds. Those formed by legislative mandate will remain in place. This is noted in lines 18 through 22 on page 2. Lines 1 through 5 on page 3. Essentially, they are not eliminated if they are consolidated. Continuing lines 7 through 14, Madam Chair, on page 3, allows for the communication between the Department of Employment, Workers' Compensation, and Workforce Services. As an example, someone applying for unemployment insurance could be directed from one department to another. The specific wording changing the name
of the Department of Employment to Workforce Services is then taken care of on some 31 different pages, sometimes in three different locations on those pages. Under the direction, for example, of director, training, buying and leasing, rulemaking, construction, collections, violations, directories, all of that taken care of as members of the Senate as we consolidate the Department of Employment into the Department of Workforce Services. Ask for your favorable approval.
All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 8, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill 8 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 9. The reading clerk will read the House bill.
House Bill number 9, sponsored by the Labor Committee. Unemployment Insurance Compliance, an act relating to unemployment insurance. It was submitted to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, and reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. I, Senator Dockstader, Martin, Nutting, Schiffer, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Scott?
I move in the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 9 do pass. There is no standing committee amendment. And, Madam Chairman, let me explain the bill briefly. First off, this is a federal compliance issue. And in this area, the feds can say you've got to comply, and the sanctions are horrendous if we don't. So we don't have too much choice. But the testimony in committee was that this bill will help our existing program. The heart of the bill is seen on page 2, line 6, where we're defining the date that somebody starts work. It's the date services for remuneration were first performed by the employee. That's important to have a very clear definition of that, because you do sometimes have confusion where as to when unemployment benefits cut off because they've gone back to work. This gives them a very clear standard, and this will help in the administration of the program, Madam Chairman. Then there's a definition at the bottom of page 2. Madam Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions about the bill. It's both a help to our program and a federal compliance issue. If not, Madam Chairman, there is a Committee of the Whole amendment.
House Bill 9, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, to engross copy, page 1, line 8.
Senator Scott.
Madam Chairman, I move adoption of the Committee of the Whole amendment. Madam Chairman, there's always room for a first. I think this is the first time I've ever had to amend an enacting clause. Our good LSO staff that keeps us out of trouble caught this typo and brought this amendment, and my compliments to the staff. They're doing their usual good work. I urge adoption of the amendment.
All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion to adopt the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 9, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Amendment Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 9 has passed. Senator Scott.
Madam Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions anybody's got in the bill.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. How do you transmit data magnetically?
Senator Scott.
Madam Chairman, I presume he's asking about some feature in the existing law. I think what they were referring to was 5.5-inch floppy disks or tapes. That may be anachronistic, but we might as well leave it there because goodness knows what somebody's going to invent next.
Questions?
All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 9, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill 9 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 12. The reading clerk will read the House bill.
House Bill number 12, sponsored by Representative Brown, Marketable Title Act, Conservation Easements, an act relating to real property. It was referred to Committee number 1, Judiciary. The work reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Perkins. Senator Perkins, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Perkins?
Thank you. Madam Chairman, I move that when the committee whole rise and report that is with a favorable recommendation of due pass on House Bill 12, Marketable Title Act Conservation Easements. And for an explanation of the bill, I ask that you would call upon the good senator from Cheyenne, Senator Ross.
Senator Ross.
Madam Chairman, bring to you House Bill 12, Marketable Title Act, Conservation Easements. This goes into the Marketable Title Act and provides a new paragraph on page 2 that basically says this act shall not be applied to bar or extinguish any claim to a conservation easement by a holder of a conservation easement or any person having a third-party rights of enforcement. And then it makes reference to the conservation easement statutes. What this does, ladies and gentlemen, is that in the Marketable Title Act itself, that a person in Section 103, which is not in this bill, a person that has legal capacity to own the land in this state, who has an unbroken chain of title of record to any interest in land for 40 years or more. So there's this 40 years provision in here. Basically what this says is that most of the time your conservation easement is going to last a lot longer than 40 years. This just basically makes it very clear that you can't extinguish the conservation easement because of failure to file a notice of claim. Pretty simple bill. Urge a favorable consideration.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just for point of information, so anybody that has a conservation easement that's been effective prior to this because of basically you can't pass a law to influence something that's already happened, the ex post facto thing, can the act be used to reach back and grab those conservation easements that have already been enacted? And if this just applies to conservation easements that are enforced or put in place after the effective date of the act.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Just to answer that question, what you've got under the Marketable Title Record or the Marketable Record Title Act is that if you want to have the perpetuation of interest, if you've got anything that doesn't appear in the record in the last 40 years, if you want to perpetuate that interest, in this case we're talking about conservation easements. You have to come out, and every 40 years, you have to make sure that there's a claim filed in the records that maintains your interest. Otherwise, it can be disregarded with respect to marketable title and whether or not you can pass that on free. What this does is there's a number of exceptions to that, and one of them is, and those exceptions are things like pipelines, highway, or railroad, or public utility easements, which are clearly observable by physical evidence, timber, minerals, hydrocarbons. Those are all accepted from having to come back and refile and make sure your claim's out there for 40 years. What this act does is it goes and makes that same exception applicable to conservation easements so that all conservation easements don't have to come back and file, and makes it not only enforceable by the individual holding that has the conservation easement, by third parties. The way that becomes important is if you go back and you look, for example, we've just passed recently large projects under the Wildlife Trust Fund, a number of large projects. While the state of Wyoming doesn't hold those easements, typically they're held by a nonprofit entity, a number of them that do these types of things, some kinds of conservation open space entities. The state of Wyoming has an interest in maintaining those conservation easements because we've paid for those in part. And so what this does is ensures that even if one of those entities that holds that conservation easement were to dissipate, disappear, dissolve, go out of existence, Wyoming would still have the right to see that those conservation easements, which we've paid good money for, would continue to be enforced. So that's my understanding of what the bill does and why you would need it. And so it applies to all of them. It exempts them from the ability to have to come back and refile every 40 years, just like railroads or other folks.
Senator Scott?
I do think this does apply to all because you're relieving a burden on the holder of the easement. You aren't changing the fundamental agreement in any way. I will say I think we have a defect in our law in this general area, which this bill does not remedy. We'll have to deal with in the future. The point in having the refiling every 40 years is so you can keep track of who holds the easement and you have some live group you can get at. I think we probably at some point in the future ought to come back and deal with that need, which is real, because you've got a conservation easement, and I think you all know that our family ranch does. You periodically have to deal with the outfit holding them, because mostly what happens, Madam Chairman, is people with eminent domain come around and want to condemn something that they have the right to condemn, like a highway department. And you have to deal with all the holders of the real interest, including the conservation easement. But you need to have a live operation that can make a decision when you get approached by one of these outfits or approached by somebody else with a commercial proposition, make it worthwhile for the holder of the conservation easement to take the deal. And I think we probably ought to have some mechanism where they're required to have be licensed to do business in the state of Wyoming, filed with the Secretary of State, have an agent for service of process, and an judicial ability for a judge to replace an organization that becomes defunct with some similar organization. But that's a more complicated bill than this one, but it would reach at the same point that the burden that this bill extinguishes does.
Senator Jennings?
Pass. Who in the state would be responsible for re-upping every 40 years?
Senator Perkins?
I'll defer to the chairman.
Senator Burns?
I'm sorry, what number are we on? This is from the Prime Minister of Israel. He wanted some advice.
Shalom.
What number are we on?
Did you want me to answer the question? Do you understand? Did you hear the question?
No, I'm sorry, I didn't.
That's your state have to answer the question.
Madam
Chairman, I think in answer to my good colleague from Natrona County, I don't think anybody in the state has that responsibility. My understanding is on the conservation easements that those are typically held by these third-party entities that are out there that are actually doing the conservation easements, and you know some of them. There's one over here in the anti-hedonic wage area that has that. There's, we also have a national one, and they actually hold those easements. And so they have the rights, and they enforce those easements. And so if they were to go defunct, the Tulsa Center from North Carolina makes a great point. If they were to go defunct, ultimately you could lose the ability for the state's interest to have these conservation easements, because I don't know that we have, and I don't know if they do or not. I'm not familiar with what the Wildlife Trust Fund and what they do over there, and if they keep track of these things and if they would step in and do that. But what we're talking about here is this
would actually protect protect to some degree both, would protect the state's interest in the event that one of those organizations went defunct. We'd still be able to step in and enforce those rights as a third-party contributor. But so the straight answer is no one in state government that I'm aware of would have that responsibility at this point.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you. So if we exempt them and they go defunct, we don't know. But if we don't pass this bill and we leave the 40-year thing in, every 40 years somebody has to come back and file to keep the thing operational. It sounds to me like that would be a better protection than exempting and let it, and like our tall colleague says, without any other mechanism in place, how are we supposed to know? So if we don't pass this, we go every 40 years, they have to come back in, and if they don't come back in, then all the flags go up, and then the state jumps in and does their thing. If we do exempt them, then it just goes on forever, and we don't know. Don't you think?
Senator Perkins?
I don't like this thing just slips silently into the ever-darkening abyss. If nobody does anything in 40 years, what happens is this now can be transferred, and if it's transferred free of notice, there's no prohibition, there's no conservation easement to whoever takes it down the road. They would take it without notice and have a good argument that there's no conservation easement on it at all. So by removing this, you're not doing it. You're not making anybody step up and do it every 40 years. It just, if nobody did it, it just disappeared, and no one may ever know about it again.
All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 12, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 12 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 13. The reading clerk will read the House bill.
House Bill 13, sponsored by Representative Brown, Wind Estate Disclosure, an act relating to property. It was referred to Committee Number 1 Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Perkins. Senator Perkins, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Madam Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 13, Wind Estate Disclosure. And for an explanation of the bill, I ask that you call upon either Senator Ross or Senator Scott. Senator Ross. Did I move the bill? I moved the bill. Thank you.
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Wind Estate Disclosure. What this bill does is it goes into the property disclosure statement portion of the law. And basically what we have here is, of course, if you recall, with regards to Wind Estate, at one point in time there was no law on it, and we passed a law that said it could not be severed. But there were several events that predated that law in which there was severance. So what this bill does is it goes into the property disclosure statement on page 34.1.151 and adds a new paragraph that requires disclosure. Unless disclosure is waived, and that's important because in paragraph B, which is right above paragraph E in this new bill, a buyer can waive the disclosure. So it says, unless the disclosure is waived, pursuant to section B, the seller of the land not within the corporate boundary, so it's out in the county, of any city or town, shall disclose in writing to a prospective buyer whether fee ownership of a wind estate has been in any way severed in the chain of title from the surface estate. So it's designed to catch those ones that have been out there in the past, and we move it into a whole new subsection because currently the way that statute is written, paragraph A, which is begins on page 1, deals with every seller of vacant land. And we make an exception if vacant land is then defined in paragraph D, which is not in this bill, which is vacant land means with no habitable dwelling and not within the boundaries of a platted subdivision or city or town and less than 140 acres. You could have situations where there actually would be a potential piece of property out there with a dwelling on it. So that wouldn't qualify as vacant land. So we moved it into a subsection E, just basically providing for disclosure. I'd urge your favorable consideration.
Will the reading clerk read Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1?
House Bill 13, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 20.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Madam Chairman, I move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 13 and ask the body's favorable consideration. As I thought about this, after it went through committee, I got to wondering about, because we had done some wind rights work a couple years ago and added a number of sections to the statute regarding wind energy rights. And so I went down and checked with the prime sponsor of the bill, and so I asked if he had thought about that or if he thought it was necessary, and he agreed that this was probably an appropriate amendment. So what this amendment does is it goes back and on line 20, on page 2, line 20 at the very end, where it says surface estate, it just would put a comma and then add the words, including the existence of a wind energy agreement as defined in Wyoming Statute 347-102A, Romanet 1, which refers back to some work we did a couple years ago. That is the definition of a wind energy agreement. A wind energy agreement is means a lease, license, easement, or other agreement, whether by grant or reservation, to develop or participate in the income from or the development of wind power energy generation. And so I thought we just, he agreed that we probably needed to add that in just to make sure we caught it. So because of what we did with our wind energy rights and making those interests in real property a couple years ago. So with that explanation, I stand for questions. And if there are no questions, I'd call for a question on the amendment.
Senator Ross.
Madam Chairman.
It's a friendly amendment, Madam Chairman.
All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion to adopt the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 13, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The motion to adopt the Committee of the Whole Amendment to House Bill 13 has passed. Are you ready for the question on the bill? All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 13, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 13 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 14.
House Bill number 14, sponsored by the Judiciary Committee, Wrongful Death Representative, an Act Relating to Civil Procedure. It was referred to Committee number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Perkins. Senator Perkins, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Perkins?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move the Committee the Whole rise and report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of due pass on House Bill 14, Wrongful Death Representative. And I have the misfortune of having to explain this bill. Madam Chairman, what we did is this was a joint judiciary interim work, and we did it because of there was a case in from the Wyoming Supreme Court called In Re Estate of Johnson, which came out in 2010, and it highlighted some problems we've got in this. The long and tortured history of the wrongful death statute is this: is that we've had it outside of the probate code, then we put it inside the probate code. I think we took it outside, then we put it back in the probate code, then we took it back outside the probate code. And so what's left of the wrongful death statute is very, very short, and it doesn't provide who would be, it doesn't give very much, if any, direction on who would be and represent the heirs and individuals who are claiming under the wrongful death statute. And so what that case pointed out was it kind of went through that tortured process, and ultimately what it did is it went back and identified, and while it said the probate code wouldn't apply because the district court would not be sitting in probate in a wrongful death action, that it would go back and apply some of the preferences and some of the other issues that you would look for a normal executor or a personal representative in a probate. That doesn't seem to be wholly appropriate in some of these actions. So it goes back, in a wrongful death action, what you're doing is someone is suing for the wrongful death of a person. And a lot of this may be something news to some members of the Senate, that when you recover in a wrongful death action, those proceeds that you get from whoever created the wrong and caused the wrongful death of that person, those funds or that recovery is not included in the probate estate. It's not part of the probate estate. It's actually a claim that's brought on behalf of maybe the surviving spouse or the children or others. So it's not part of the decedent's probate estate. It's a claim that's typically by family members who were depending on the person who was killed. And so what that's done is it's created a lot of confusion because we're trying to pull in the probate code into this thing, and we end up with the probate code has a completely different person as a personal representative of the probate code than you do as kind of a trustee in representing the wife or the surviving kids or whoever has an interest in the estate. So ultimately that's what this bill tries to do. It goes out and attempts to solve that problem. And so what we do is we start out and we pull and create new statutes that will identify who serves as the wrongful death representative in wrongful death action and does a number of things. So going through the bill very quickly, what we've got is at the bottom of page 1, on top of page 2, we have the wrongful death representative. It's going to be appointed by the district court in the county. It's going to be appointed by the judge where the wrongful death case is brought typically. And so you have it has those designations there on pages 1 and 2 over the top of 3. Then the factors for determining who the wrongful death representative. It can be actually quite adversarial about who it is. If you have an estranged wife versus children, adult children, or other people who are claiming in wrongful death, it can be fairly adversarial. So only what this does is it gives the court some direction on who would serve and what factors they would look at in determining if you have multiple people applying to be the wrongful death representative, how they would go about that. Pages 4 and 5, you see the notice that goes out so that you have notice that goes out so that all the people who might be claiming under this wrongful death, in this wrongful death action, have notice of who the representative is going to be and how they would go about doing that. Then you see those are the new sections. Then on pages 6 and 7, we're going back to the wrongful death statute and just making some conforming amendments so that they comply with the new sections that we've just talked about in the earlier pages of the bill. And with that, Madam Chairman, I'd stand for questions.
All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 14, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 14 has passed the Committee of the Whole.
Madam Chairman.
Majority Floor Leader, Senator Ross.
Madam Chairman, I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You have heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. House Bill 121, do pass amended. House Bill 32, do pass amended. House Bill 10, do pass. House Bill 25, do pass amended. House Bill 29, do pass. House Bill 26, do pass.
House Bill 36.
House Bill 36, do pass. House Bill 52 do pass. House Bill 8 do pass. House Bill 9 do pass amended. House Bill 12 do pass. House Bill 13 do pass amended. And House Bill 14 do pass. Senator Nutting, Chairman.
Senator Nutting.
Mr. President, I move for the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That report has been adopted. Before we move on, we have some reports from standing committees I think we ought to read in.
February the 28th, 2012, Mr. President, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 40, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Barnard, Emmerich, Hines, and Perkins, no. Senator Case, Senator Hines, Chairman. February the 28th, 2012, Mr. President, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 38, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Barnard, Emmerich, Hines, and Perkin. No, Senator Case, Senator Hines, Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate stand adjourned until 10 a.m. Wednesday, February 29th.
Are there any announcements? I would call on Senator Geis.
Mr. Chairman, your committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Land, and Water Resources, will meet in about 10 minutes in S-15 to take up House Bill 41 and listen to the livestock market report.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals, will meet tomorrow at noon or 15 minutes after noon recess up in S-18, and we're going to talk about what kind of opportunity we want to have to interview people for their appointments for the governor's list, Mr. President. Okay.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in the normal committee room. House Bill 82, engrossed, public assistance drug testing.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 2, Mr. President, will meet upon adjournment in S-13 to consider the following bills. House Bill 87, mixed martial arts. House Bill 90, engrossed. Baseline scientific assessments, and House Bill 1, General Government Appropriations 2. Tomorrow upon adjournment, S-13.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 1, Judiciary, will meet Wednesday, February the 29th at 8 a.m. in room S-1 to consider the following bills. House Bill 2, Engrossed Service of Process Fees. House Bill 54, Crime Victim Service Providers Reporting. House Bill 63, Child Custody Modification After Military Service. House Joint Resolution 9, Engrossed Mandatory Judicial Retirement.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. President, your committee number 8, Transportation, will meet on Wednesday, February 29th, upon adjournment in room S-14 to take up House Bill 21, Exceeding Speed Limit While Passing, and House Bill 22, Gold Star License Plates, Expanded Eligibility.
Any other announcements? Seeing none, you've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Senate shall stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow, Wednesday, February 29th. We are adjourned.